Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agro-homeopath Pavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community. And today, our regular co-host, Pavi Raj, author of the international bestseller, Homeopathy for Farm and Garden, is traveling and unable to attend the show. In his place is Dr. Robert Bruck, my husband and plant pathologist and forester at North Carolina State University. And we're going to talk about organic farming, about agriculture, agro-homeopathy, and many other items of interest that is in the news today, which is January 5th, 2011, and you're listening to show number 11 on how homeopathy helps grow great gardens. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I have not opened up the chat line over there in the Blog Talk Radio. I'm going to do that now, so if anybody who is listening wants to join us, you can comment. Send us information there, questions, and we will respond in the best way that we can without having Pavi Raj with us. Oops. And for some reason, hopefully, that is not going... Okay. We have a reverberation. I'm not sure... Okay. Something had opened up, and we had a reverberation. Apologize for that. And so now we have the chat line open today, and I'm in the switchboard, and we're going to go ahead with the show. Let me check and see if Dr. Bruck is with us. We're waiting for him to call in. In the meantime, I will get the kinks out of the getting started today. I want to remind everybody that there is a daily homeopath newspaper that goes online from the people who are on the homeopath list. Pavi Raj is one of the contributors, so take a look at what articles he's linking to and items of interest there. It is called the http://paper.li/andmyname.debbiebruck/homeopaths. It is the Homeopath Daily. And we are going to be talking about the future of agriculture today. And a author called Elizabeth Maginis has written an article that we're going to talk about. I appreciate everyone's patience with today's show, getting it going and waiting for our co-host to get on the line. In the meantime, agro-homeopathy is going to be a new terminology that is going to hit the airwaves for farmers and home gardeners, hobbyists, to understand what that means and how we apply it to our crops and our home garden, indoor gardening and outdoor gardening. What does it mean to introduce homeopathy into our practices to keep plants alive and healthy? And we know that pesticides, insecticides, fungicides are not supporting the plants in the way that they need to sustain themselves and support their soil in a healthy manner. So this is a term, agro-homeopathy, that we're going to be talking about. It is an influence in the biological processes of plants that affect their growth and control plagues and infestation and other kinds of disease. the question that the author, Elizabeth Maginus, states is this or could this be the future of agriculture? We're going to find out also that there are many studies being going on around the world using homeopathy to grow plants that attest to and give us proof that homeopathy works. And if this is going to be one of the avenues that initiate acceptance of homeopathy as a viable form of healing, then we can all do it in our gardens and gather the data and tell people in our location, in our communities, that this is the way to take care of infestation from bugs, from pests, from fungi, and all sorts of things in any kind of plant that we are growing. Homeopathy, as we do know, is a form of, they're calling it alternative medicine. I would say it's a main form of medicine, a very viable form of medicine that shows its longevity over 200 years of use. It is based on, she says, quote unquote, based on the theory that all disease originates from disruptions in an individual's life force. These life force disturbances or miasms cause the symptoms that are unique to a particular diseased state. Homeopaths believe that a negative state of mind creates these energetic disease states out of the individual's life force. In other words, all disease originates within the individual, not a separate invading entity, unquote. Now, I might say that she stated it in a simplistic manner, and to say that it comes out of the state of mind, a negative state of mind, I don't know that I would agree 100% with that statement. We call it a life force, an energetic force, what maintains the person in life. And there are many qualities to that. So there is your thinking, your consciousness. There are your emotions. And it is something beyond simplistic description. So when we talk about that in terms of a plant, I'm getting into a realm that I'm not sure about. In other words, can plants think? Well, they do have a life force. It may not be as high on the spiritual spectrum as humans, but they do have a life force. And like we say, the canary in the coal mine, they indicate what's happening in our environment. I'm still waiting for, okay, I see that Dr. Brooke has called in.
Hear me?
Yes, I apologize. I was so busy going ahead with the show that I did not notice that you had actually called in there. And were you able to hear what I have been talking about so far, Dr. Brock?
Yes. I'm calling on my cell phone right now. For some reason, the landline would not go through. I was only getting a busy signal. But I'm on. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming in. It's a little bit fuzzy, but maybe I can improve the sound from my end. I will see if I can do that.
Okay, well, I'm on my cell phone, and I heard what you said in terms of this particular article. It's kind of interesting, dealing with agro-homeopathy. The author of this particular article goes into really quite a bit of detail about the utility of using homeopathy. And one of the things that goes with the statement that you just made, that the plant has a life force, is the principle of autonoso. So I've never heard that particular word before, but I want to read from the article quickly. An autonoso represents the most immediate way to extend the use of homeopathy to farmers and gardeners. They only require the plant damaged by the disease or plague, along with a bottle of alcohol with which to prepare the dynamization. It is easy, uncomplicated, and an immediate process that counters the damage by the plague or the disease. Correct me. Am I correct by saying that by taking a diseased plant and actually using the extract from that plant and potentizing it will act as a curative factor in terms of like cures like?
Well, I'm thinking that this author is not completely conversant about what homeopathy is, because homeopathy is based on likes, cures, likes. It's this principle of similars. And
right.
What you are speaking of right now is called isopathy, which means it is exactly the same thing. So she's saying to take some disease or some part of the plant and give it back to the plant. And to do that, it's more of an isopathic method. And the idea of the autonosode, or what did you call it?
Yeah, well, the author calls it an autonosode.
Okay. I'm not finding that part of the article, but so she does read in the beginning, she introduces Samuel Hahnemann as the German physician who first proposed homeopathy as a viable medical philosophy, and I would like to emphasize it is a viable medical system. And reason that from his experimentation that certain substances, when ingested in small doses, and here she's limited it to ingestion, where we can, based on the Organon of Medicine, we can apply it through the skin and through the olfactory senses. So even if you are to sniff it, the correct similimum, then you are going to introduce a response in the organism. So, you know, her article is very simplistic and doesn't give the entire picture. So she continues to say it's produced the same symptoms as those associated with the particular disease states. This theory forms the basis of Hahnemann's law of similars, like let like be cured by like. So when she's talking about taking disease matter from a plant, so let's say a plant has a fungi or fungus on it, and or it has a particular insect that is eating the plant leaves or the roots or whatever, then if you take the exact same thing and turn it into a homeopathic remedy by potentizing it, titrating it, and succussing it, potentizing it into a energetic form of that substance, then it is what she's calling an autonosode or more of an isopathic form of treatment. Does that help?
Yeah, I think so. I'm reading this article again many times over, and it's interesting how she goes into two different aspects. The first part of the article deals with this concept of autonosode in agrohomeopathy, by which she mentions Mexican farmers with a plague, a disease, damage from fertilizer, pesticides, or excessive salinity can be supported or cured by applying dynamizations to the plants before, during, and after sowing, and again, using the plant as the actual curative agent. But then, the second half of her article, she goes into a long rubric talking about the use of silica, carbo-veg, apis, calcarea, magnesia, with specific symptoms and specific diseases that affect the plant. I'll just read the first one for silica. For slow-growing plants, attacks of mildew or other fungi, interruptions in growth, and delay in production. So this seems to be a overall curative agent for plants exhibiting those particular symptoms. Then for carbo-veg, it says, after attacks of defoliating insects, water deficiency, change in temperature, flowers falling off, bud death, or plants that are planted in compacted soil. So she goes on with a very long list here of potential curative agents. So I guess she's approaching it from two different aspects.
If Kaviraj was here, he would be able to explain more thoroughly, but he has stated in previous shows that silicio or silica is the number one homeopathic remedy that supports plant growth. And he also tells us that there are certain times and sequences in order to apply your homeopathic remedies to your plant crops so that you are giving it a sequence of supporting that plant through the process of its normal cycle. And as is stated in the article by that you're reading, which is, this is Meneses Moreno, Niurka Meneses Moreno, and the article can be found on HPathy, and she wrote it 2 years ago about agriculture and farming with homeopathy. Therefore, she is well-versed in homeopathy. She gives us the delineation of specific homeopathic plant remedies that help in certain instances. So if you're observing in your plants these symptoms, you can then apply these specific remedies. So silica, as I was saying, supports the plant, and something that is too weak to stand up needs that silica, and there are many remedies, many plants that require that. And carbovegetabilis is a remedy that's used for when we don't have enough oxygen. So here you see it is stated after the attacks of defoliating insects, water deficiency, change of temperature, flowers falling off, bud death, and plants in compact soil, which means that there is not enough oxygen getting to the plant to support it and provide nutrients to it. That's why the carbovegetabilis will probably come in that instance. The next one that is listed is the Apis mellifica, which is honeybee. And we know that used in humans, it's for bee stings, because Apis is a bee sting. It's for swelling, inflammation, heat in the location of the injury. So here he's stating, for very thin plants due to high production, varieties with low heat tolerance, which is also an indication for Apis mellifica, because when a person indicates that they do not want heat, but they want cold application, that is when we select Apis for supporting the life organism. It also is talking about low fertility of pollen and falling off of flowers and fruits. So obviously honeybees are known for their agent of pollinating plants. And those are just three of the ones that are listed in the article. You can tell me if you have comments or you want some more information on that.
I'm sort of interested in one thing, and you know, help me to understand better. When we're talking about homeopathy with regards to human beings, what we're discussing is the fact that human beings are, I mean, we already know that 99.99% of our genome is identical. It doesn't matter what our race is, where we come from. We are identical, and therefore, when we talk about a set of symptoms, again, the like cures like of Hahnemann, I can very easily understand how we can use very similar cures, very similar substances, homeopathic remedies, for a given set of symptoms. Yet the thing that kind of intrigues me, and I'm not questioning it, but it's intriguing that when we're talking about plants, the difference between the genome of a corn plant or a pine tree, there is probably less than 5% of genetic convergence between those species, other than the fact that they're photosynthesizing green plants. They are very, very different. They require very, very different sets of circumstances in terms of growth, nutrients, in order for them to thrive. yet it appears, and it seems that Kaviraj and others will come up with a remedy based on a common set of symptoms, like compact soil or defoliation or whatever, that will work across the entire spectrum of plants. That, to me, is very intriguing in the sense that we are dealing with systems that are, at least phylogenetically, very, very separated from each other.
I don't think that he would say that. He is a classical homeopath, meaning that each instance is unique and has to be viewed as separate based on the homeopath's knowledge about understanding of symptoms. So a corn plant has a specific place where it will grow, the environment. He's looking at the soil. He's looking at what kind of companions, what's living around that plant, what enhances that type of a plant to grow. He is looking at the weather and climate variables. He is looking at the corn plant itself, which may be different in different parts of the world. And he is taking it on a case-by-case basis. However, there are symptoms that are common. So, I mean, you would know better in terms of what kind of, like, corn smut would be a common plant disease in the corn plant itself. And therefore, there are a set of remedies that assist a plant with a certain set of symptoms. So you're looking at a fungus, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so you're looking at a fungus infestation, you're looking at how fast it is spreading, you're looking at what happens to the plant when it incurs this type of disease, and what remedies in the past have been used as a curative agent for that. And we even use this remedy, corn smut, for humans when there are female problems. I think that is correct. I would have to look it up specifically. So we know that it is like cures like, and we do take it on a case-by-case basis, but we also see similarities in the way that the homeopathic remedies address the problem. So I could give you another example. Someone who comes in with a headache, we don't just across the board give everybody the same remedy because they have a headache. But if it depends upon the way that headache is displayed in that individual. So if it's a pounding headache, if it's a shooting pain, if it's all day, if it's only during the night, you know, we have to take all of that in account. And because we're talking about plants, they can't tell us what's going on. We can only use our powers of observation, which makes us even a better homeopath. So
right.
You need to be able to smell what is the odor that is given off. What is there crowding in that? What kind of weeds or other plants then begin to invade the area? There are so many different factors that you can be taking note of. What happens to the plant's roots or stem when it is invaded by, or the fruiting body when it is invaded by a particular disease? And does that clarify the fact that we just don't across the board give something for whatever a name disease?
It does. Well, what's very refreshing also about this particular article is at the end of it, there are 13 references that are citing published papers from homeopathic journals in Mexico, Great Britain, actually several books from India, including a very high-profile publication here, published by Kluwer Academic Press out of the Netherlands, talking about ultra-high dilutions of homeopathic remedies in a wheat model, And I think that just this simply bolsters the reality that, as you said, by actually conducting the experiments on plants that can't talk back to us and can't tell us how healthy they are, but rather looking at such qualities as yields, quality, growth parameters as a direct, objective, empirical way of assessing the value of a remedy, this obviously seems to have an awful lot of credibility. Very interesting.
Very high credibility, and that's why, in a way, I feel that using agrohomeopathy, it's going to be the introduction to the rest of the world about, I mean, we all need to eat. We're all dependent upon our survival for air, water, and food. And if we're going to produce higher yields, healthier plants, and get our nutrition from our what we eat, and we are what we eat, and if we can see with our own eyes in the grocery store or the farmers in the field, see that they're enhancing their livelihood, enhancing the plants, enhancing the yields, then we're going to start to move in this direction. And there's going to be no doubt in anyone's mind that homeopathy works. And if it works for plants, it also works for pets, and it also works for humans. So I do believe that this might be the tipping point, as you might say, of what's happening in the world today. And we will give the link to this article so that people can look at the photographs and see the comparison of what a plant looks like before and after homeopathic treatment. And anybody at home can actually do this in their own house. There is an article somewhere, I don't have it at the tips of my fingers, using the sundew plant, the Drosera plant, on HWC, Homeopathy World Community, which is an age-old test of putting a drop of a substance on this plant and seeing what happens to it homeopathically. And that will be interesting. If I remember, I will put it on the blog. And on the particular article, they're showing radish plants, which grows in a very short number of days, and you can see dramatic change in production. You can see that in the homeopathically treated radish plants, the fruit is much larger and healthier looking than those that have not been treated at all. So it's kind of like using a control. Also, I want to take note to those who are just listening for the first time, Kaviraj has spoken about the potency of using homeopathic remedies on plants, and that they are much simpler and less complex than humans, and therefore he only gives them a low potency, which might be cell salt, a 6X, a 3X, or a very low potency of a 6C or a 30C. He does not typically go up to a 200C, except in the case of trees, which are a little bit more developed than those plants that just grow close to the ground, like vegetable crops.
Let me carry on here. I want to bring up the other article that we decided to discuss, which is very recent. This was an article published by Kaviraj in the Homeopathic Journal, Volume 3, Issue Number 12, October 2010, just 3 months ago. An extensive article called Agrohomeopathy, An Approach to Diagnosis. And the thing that is really kind of interesting here is what Kaviraj is talking about in this excellent article, which is also filled with very nice photographs, is what I will simply call ecology. It's obvious. You figure out what he's saying without even being educated, because it makes so much sense. Yet it's amazing how mainstream agriculture has fallen away from these principles. Just to give you an example, I'm just quoting again from the practical application section. He begins with the obvious things, climate and weather. Where are you planting? Okay, your plant. What are you growing? What is the soil? Okay, he talks about the basic medium of growth, in which, as you pointed out, silica is the basis of all soils, and he goes on to talk about micro and macronutrients. What are the soil microbiota? What are the allelopathic chemicals that help suppress weeds, pests, and diseases? These are all natural phenomena that have evolved literally over hundreds of millions of years to make plants grow where they grow and be, in quotes, happy. The inverse of that, of course, is modern agriculture, where we have decided to take complete control of the entire system. I'll just quote from another article that was published today. This came from the New York Times, a study, quote, no-till farming reduces greenhouse gases. And just to recap this, greenhouse, one of the most deadly of the greenhouse gases, over 3,000 times more potent than carbon dioxide, is nitrous oxide. Okay, 65% of all the man-made nitrous oxide in the world comes from modern agriculture. Deep tilling, the application of nitrogen fertilizers, okay, and the very, very quick dissolution of these substances in highly tilled or disked soils. Here is a concrete series of experiments done in the United States by the U.S. Department of Agriculture proving that you literally reduce the amount of nitrogen oxide in no-tilled fields by 58%. What no-till means is that you leave the soil in the natural condition. You simply poke a hole in the soil to put your seed, leave the organic matter, leave the organic material and the humus on the surface of the soil, let the soil be fertilized naturally from the breakdown of that organic matter, and lo and behold, you grow a very, very sufficient crop, and you reduce the amount of greenhouse gas being released. Kavi would say the exact same thing, is that by having natural systems and trying to go back to a natural system, organic agriculture, not only are we proving day by day that it works, but the amount of pollution that we avoid, the quality of the crops that we are able to harvest are far superior to that of what we euphemistically call the Green Revolution after World War II, where we had decided we're going to control everything. We're going to control the soil. We're going to control the nutrients. We're going to control the microbiology through pesticides. We're going to control the weeds. We're going to control the organic matter. We're going to use artificial irrigation in order to bolster the crop, and we're going to use tremendous amounts of hydrocarbon, not only in doing it, but releasing those hydrocarbons, like nitrous oxides, into the environment, which now we find out is causing global warming. So really, what I think Kaviraj is discussing in his agro-homeopathy sections is going back to nature, which organic gardeners figured out all along, and in which, I think, as you stated, Debbie, more and more of mainstream agriculture is beginning to recognize as the future of food production.
Right. And you know what? I think all life swings from one end to the other, and I'm hoping that we're going to have a balance, a moderation in life. And I also see that what he's talking about, you forgot to mention one thing, is monocultures also, which is very detrimental to the life of plants, because one thing can wipe it out like an epidemic. And we need to have that natural diversity in populations, which means living in harmony, letting the plant live in harmony with its environment and enhancing for it the natural way that it has grown and evolved over millennia, really, generations, to become what it is today. And when you start, as you say, to control, this is a very miasmatic terminology, miasmatic in terms of cancer, the overgrowth of cells, the improper growing of cells. This is because of undue control imposed from an outside force. And we see it in our own population. And if we're eating plants that have been so forced into living in a way that's not natural for it and controlled in this way, we're ingesting this information that it might be at a very low level, but we're eating something that's really not a happy plant. And we've got now depression in the human population. So as we go back to nature, as we begin to understand that we have to live in harmony and cooperation and know that symbiotic relations are good for us, then we're going to have a happier planet. And I have a little quote on, or something that I say on the front page of Homeopathy World Community, that if we heal the earth, we heal ourselves. And I do really believe that when we heal the earth, we do heal ourselves. And if it starts with the plants and our healing, replenishing our soil, what it needs to be going back to nature and not tilling it up and exposing what's supposed to be down under the earth, constantly releasing what's supposed to be in there for a reason, to probably develop the good bacteria that are there. And that's another thing, antibiotics and things in our body that we expose it to and don't let the natural flora and fauna live. And that is what organic gardening is all about, understanding the natural processes and helping it in the way that it knows best. Do you have a question?
In this article that he has in the Homeopathic Journal, he gives a very specific example that to me is fascinating. What is coccinella? Can you remind me of that?
That is the ladybug.
Okay, that's great, because I'm reading from this here, okay? Starting from scratch, the first remedy made of a predator, coccinella, set us on the trail to try out more remedies under the same vein. So what he's saying is that we already know, and this is knowledge that's been around for thousands of years, that ladybugs, which of course are innocuous creatures, they're not poisonous to us or to anything else, are in fact predators. They are carnivores that eat aphids and thrips, two of the most egregious problems that you find out in gardens and in agricultural systems, causing billions of dollars in damage. And so apparently what homeopaths have done is, and this was the first one he says, was took a homeopathic preparation of coccinella. Okay, and he makes it very clear that, in fact, the dose is so small that it cannot be detected by any chemical test, but only by its effects on the living plant system by potentizing the coccinella, by spraying it onto crops, you are actually inducing a similar effect as to the actual ladybug itself. So here is a known predator of plant-eating insects that will eat them, but on the other hand, a homeopathic preparation will prevent them in the first place, the aphids and thrips on brassicas and grains, he points out, from ever attacking those plants. So that's pretty cool stuff.
Right. So if aphids and thrips are eaten by the coccinella, the beetle, which is the ladybug,
right,
and there is some sort of a sensing of the vital force of these insects to say, well, the predator that's going to eat me has been here,
right,
left a trail, left a trace, then this is not a place for me to be. And basically it's the remedy is taken in by the plant once it is, you know, he says that we spray, and I have to remind people who have not been listening, what he does to apply a homeopathic remedy is he dilutes it in very high doses in water, and then the application is to the soil. And then, like our mouth, like ingesting or imbibing something, the plant takes the homeopathic remedies up through the roots and into the entire plant through the roots, the circulatory system of the plant, and therefore it has the qualities of the coccinella within it. So it is a natural, it's like a natural repellent. That's what it is.
Right. It's taken up systemically, and it's in virtually all the cells of the plant.
Right.
Which, of course, is fascinating, because that's exactly what genetic engineers are trying to do by playing around with the genetics of the plant. The example there would be BT corn, Bacillus thuringiensis, where we've known for 50 years that there is a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis that will actually attack the caterpillars on corn plants and other different insect pathogens. And so we actually take the gene that codes for that toxin and put it into every cell of the plant. And, of course, does it work? Yeah, it does work. When the caterpillar feeds on the plant, they end up dying after a bite. On the other hand, every cell of the plant is now contaminated with BT toxin internally. What Kavi is saying is, as in the case of this coccinella, is by taking a dilution beyond Avogadro's number, beyond the point where you can even detect a single molecule of the essence of that particular predator, by having that being taken up systemically through the roots of the plant. Now, again, it's in every cell of the plant. It cannot even be measured. It has absolutely no ill effect either on the plant or on the people who eat it, yet it will act as a natural repellent to the aphids and thrips in this particular case, and they've actually proven this experimentally.
Yes. So when gene jerkers go into their labs and start to play around with the genetic codes and such, we really don't know what the effects are going to be. We don't know how it will affect not only the plant and the plant's symbiotic relationship or relationship with other things in its environment. We don't know what is going to be the chain reaction of those changed genes in the rest of the environment. Actually, we do know. We know that it causes sterility, and it causes these monocultures to be extremely susceptible to other kinds of disease over the long term. And then when we eat these plants, we don't really know what it does to our genes, to our genetic code, and how it might weaken us as human beings. Instead of allowing the individual and the vital force to strengthen itself through disease, to have a natural resistance by, this is another article we have on HWC is about fever. Fever is a symptom that there's something of a disorder in the organism, and it is the natural means of clearing that disorder. And if we go in and prevent the human being or the organism from performing its natural function to disable whatever it is that's causing the germ, then we're not strengthening that vital force. So of course, if a fever gets too high, then we have to take some external action, mechanical action. But in truth, we really don't know that much about the genetics and what we're playing around with. We have a little bit of information, which can be kind of scary, because we don't really know.
When we're talking about the BT, which of course is the most ubiquitous thing that's in the agricultural market now, it's beyond simply the genetics. What you're doing is actually coding for that toxin in the plant. The toxin's in the plant, not the essence of the toxin, the actual toxin. And there have been a number of cases where we have actually seen allergic reactions to that toxin in corn, soybeans, a number of other plants that are eaten by people. And, of course, they're trying to search for other things that we can do it. The justification, of course, is that by doing that, we don't have to spray parathione and 7 and malathione and all these nasty chemicals. But the inverse is yes, instead of spraying them and potentially washing them off, now we're introducing the same chemical directly into every gene of the plant, albeit at low levels. But as you just said, do we really understand the long-term implications of doing this? The answer is no. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. Anybody who says different is not telling the truth. These things have only been around for a little over a decade. The idea of ingesting these plants over many decades of time in terms of chronic effects, negative effects to the human population and certainly to the ecology of the agroecosystem is simply unknown. So you're
right. We're basically playing around with our own genetic code and what the codes are that are in the environment. I would like to tell anyone who is listening to the show today that Viktor Kolaskai of, I think he's in Bulgaria, has posted on HWC a link to 1 million voices for GE-free future. And there is an EU petition there that you can go and help sign. And there are some other petitions out there. So we really are not interested in having these GM crops. And the only way we can change that, this is an initiative by Greenpeace, by the way, the only way that we can change that is if we stand up and speak out. And the way that we do that is not only by petitions, but what we buy in our stores, where we put our money down in our pocketbook, or if we go to our local growers and our local organic farmers and say, we really appreciate what you're doing, sticking your neck out and going against the grain here to plant not with the use of fertilizers and other kinds of weed, insecticides and pesticides and all that kind of thing that we now know is going to go into the runoff into our water and going to harm our environment by the continuous buildup of that. So do we want to talk a little bit more about this diagnosis and the 5 points that Kaviraj has spoken about, soil, weather, nutrients, crop, and biome?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, he calls it the 5 quintessential points of knowledge, and that we all know that the plant has the soil in which it lives, the weather or environment, climate, and the nutrients that it needs. And then we're talking about what kind of crop it is and the biome. Give me a definition of biome.
The biome is the ecosystem.
Okay, and the ecosystem. So everything that's living around it. And those are the main points of information that people should be familiar with in order to grow their plants. And I, in my own little garden here with a small amount of property, if I put a plant, I tried to grow my hydrangeas under the pine trees for like 10 years. And it was a measly little plant that really did not do well. And then when I moved it out into more sunshine away from the pine trees, they are now, what would you say, they're 5 feet tall. They get huge. And their flowers are huge. And if you enhance them with some of your homeopathic remedies or introduce leaf mulch and organic material to the earth, they're going to do even better. So those are the types of things that you need to know. And then in terms of symbiotic relationships, Kaviraj has lists and lists of plants that live together happily and help each other. For instance, we are all familiar with the tomatoes and the basil plant. And not only do they grow well together, they taste delicious together. So those are things that we know.
Yeah, let me talk about something else here, which is very interesting. When he talks about those five factors that you just brought up, again, soil, weather, nutrients, crops, and biome, or the ecosystem, then he goes on to talk about the practical applications. And again, I repeat myself that it is almost like a recitation of agroecology. So I'm going to just briefly go through them. He goes, number one, these are the practical applications, okay, of the close-knit relationship of plants within their ecosystem. One, it begins above the surface with the climate and the weather. Below the surface in the soil, we have the flora and the fauna consisting of billions of living entities, all of which influence the plant life. This is the basic environment. Then number two, this includes the micro and macronutrients, the fungi, both protective and antagonistic, okay? People need to understand, this is one of my fields of specialty, okay, soil microbiology. Okay, if you take a single gram of soil out of your garden and had it analyzed, you will find that there are literally millions of organisms in there. You will find not only good organisms that help promote the growth of a plant, but you will find pathogenic organisms. So then the question would be, well, how come the pathogenic organisms simply don't overwhelm the plant and kill it? And the fact is, and I put this in quotes, in a healthy soil system, the antagonistic organisms will keep the pathogens in check. When you have soil diseases or soil-borne diseases, more often than not, the reason why the pathogen is able to overcome the plant is that the good microbiota, the good organisms, these are bacteria, fungi, actinomycetes, have been destroyed in the soil due to fertilizers and pesticides, allowing the pathogen to go on. We have the same analogies in human beings. Okay, a lot of people would say that infection, most infections, are the result of a compromised immune system, and that if a human being is truly healthy, even if they're in a room filled with pathogens, people are sneezing and coughing, they are not going to get sick. So the same thing goes on with plants. Number three, above ground, we have the direct protective and antagonistic companion plants and weeds. That's what you just talked about, Debbie, that what's being planted in and around the actual crop plant is going to have a very profound aspect on the health of the system. Number four, each plant is an expression of the partaking of a remedy derived from all of its parts. And number five, from the Materia Medica, we can learn about the relationships of the communities, the plants, and the elements that partake in the life of the agricultural system. In other words, when something is out of balance, we can use the Materia Medica, homeopathy, to be able to treat that condition and bring it back into a balance without using all of the toxic chemicals that are standard in agriculture today. So I think he has very nicely come up with a very short but concise thesis as to what the agroecosystem is about, how it works, that when it is in balance, that normally there are not problems. When it is out of balance, there are problems, and how homeopathy can help remediate those things.
Right. He is a wonderful teacher, and I'm looking forward to having him back with us to get involved in the conversation. So he says, each plant is an expression of the consciousness we experience after partaking of the remedy derived from it or its parts. It has its particular mentality and emotional life. and is as such a sick individual, specifically in the artificial environment we have created for them. So he's saying that when a living organism is placed in an artificial environment, that is when it becomes ill. Hence, the relationships tend to follow those that are expressed in the materia medica, and what is not there we can discover by studying the relevant literature. So we can see when in our materia medica the expression of that plant. So if we understand belladonna and what happens when humans will be in contact with the toxins and the poison of that plant, we understand that there is a life to that plant and an expression of that plant, a consciousness that is expressed when another organism is in touch with that. So we learn about plants through reading the literature of how people have been poisoned or under provings, clinical trials, and have taken those particular plants into their being. And on number 5, from the Materia Medica, we can learn about relationships in communities of plants. He's very, very interested in the life of plant and how they live with other plants. And that is why companion planting is so very important, to be able to use those natural relationships when we are doing our own agricultural growing.
I think what's so interesting about what he's saying, and again, he's sort of a man ahead of his time, is that we, again, have come out of 50 years of complete and total manipulation of agroecosystems, and we patted ourselves on the back. Norman Borlaug received a Nobel Prize for dealing with all of this stuff about how we are going to grow more and more food. Yet, that work of the 50s and 60s panned out that by the time we reached 1983, the yield and quality of global crop production on a per acre or per hectare basis has actually gone down. And the reason why it has gone down, as Kavi is pointing out, is that in a nutshell, we have simply contaminated and destroyed the natural ecosystem that these plants are growing in. So now we're doing a 180, and more sustainable agronomists, organic agronomists, and people using alternative therapies are finding out that indeed, if you start with a healthy ecosystem and maintain it that way, you don't have the problems of fungi and insects and negative organisms impacting the actual growth and yield of your plants. So we're sort of in a new age right now where more and more people are catching on to this reality because, quite frankly, we learned back in the 70s and 80s that we can't afford to continue going this way because by destroying the soil, we are not only destroying the ecosystem that it's in, but ultimately contaminating human populations, inducing cancers and other problems. So I think that homeopathy has a tremendous future in the agricultural market.
Okay, well, we only have 30 seconds left or so, so I'm going to summarize that we do need to clean up our environment, both for humans and plants. We need to go back to nature and become observant of our plants and how they live because they are our teachers, that we are a part of the ecosystem, the chain of events of what eats what. And we are going to go into 2011, into the new year, with agro-homeopathy as the lead way of improving our environment. And I want to thank everyone for listening today. We're going to close the show with our soft music. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Rob, for being with me today.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaikuthanath and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.